It was a frantic race to finish up legislation on Beacon Hill this weekend, which didn't wrap up until early this morning. State lawmakers worked until after midnight getting some key bills passed before the clock ran out on this legislative session under the rules. When it was over, Senate President Stan Rosenberg proclaimed the session a success.
A lot of quality legislation came out of the Senate through the entire 18-month period. A lot of our top priorities made it through the Senate and to the governor's desk. Others will pick up again next year.
WBUR's Steve Brown was at the State House all weekend long following the events and joins us now from the WBUR State House Bureau on Beacon Hill, where he actually spent the night making sense of the chaos. Morning, Steve.
Good morning, Bob.
So lawmakers went right down to the wire with override votes and votes on some major pieces of legislation. What did they get accomplished?
Well, they passed four key bills, and I'll get to those in a minute. They also spent a lot of time dealing with some budget veto overrides. Now, by my tally, they put back over $227 million to the budget. That's leaving only $28 million of the governor's $256 million worth of vetoes intact. Of course, the governor has been warning that they might be cutting things a little too close by restoring all that money. A couple of other key overrides that took place. The Mass Cultural Council funding was restored. The legislature put back $7.7 million to arts programs around the state. They also overrode the governor's veto of language, which mandates that insurance companies cover long-term antibiotic treatment of Lyme disease. Now, that's a treatment that's not accepted by everyone in the medical community.
How about legislation? When they were going into the weekend, there were five major bills identified by the governor and legislative leaders as priorities. Did they get them all done?
Not all of them. The ones that did include the TNC or Ride for Hire bill. It imposes regulations on Uber and Lyft. The final compromise does not include requiring Uber and Lyft drivers be fingerprinted, but they must be subject to a two-step background check by both the company and the state. The final compromise now does not limit TNCs from operating at Logan Airport or at the Boston Convention Center. Those were restrictions that the House wanted in there. They did include a 20-cent per ride surcharge, with that money going back to cities and towns to help maintain roads. Another last-minute agreement came on the $740 million economic development bill. The final version of that did not contain a Senate proposal to extend the state's hotel and motel tax to online short-term rentals like Airbnb. And also an energy bill requiring utilities to purchase 1,600 megawatts from renewable sources, including offshore wind and hydropower, passed. Gone from the final version is Senate language barring utilities from obtaining rate increases from customers in order to pay for building new natural gas pipelines. Now, while it's not everything that he'd hoped for, George Bachrach of the Environmental League of Massachusetts is pleased with that bill.
Well, all of us want to move faster and further than we have, but this is a very important start. We have no wind farms, offshore wind farms, in America today. Massachusetts will be first to have a commercially scaled wind farm.
And finally, municipal modernization passed. That eliminates all sorts of antiquated laws that have hampered municipal governments. One provision that did not make it into that final compromise bill would have removed the requirement that the city of Boston have to ask the legislature for permission to increase the number of liquor licenses in the city. Mayor Marty Walsh wanted the city to have that authority on its own. But for now, any increase in liquor licenses must continue to receive the legislature's blessing first.
All right, Steve, what didn't make it by the deadline in terms of major pieces of legislation?
Well, the bill limiting non-compete agreements between employees and employers was the only bill that was considered as one of the six major priorities that didn't make it. It came close, but conferees just could not reach a compromise. Bills that weren't on that list of six priorities didn't make it this weekend as well. There were a lot of folks from the Gun Owners Action League up here on Saturday urging that legislators take up some bills that would restrict what the Attorney General can do in terms of her interpretation of the state's assault weapons ban. Speaker Bob DeLeo said there was no way that a gun bill could be taken up in 2 days. Another group was up here Saturday as well, calling for bills promoting racial justice. They held a rally, but alas, those bills were not taken up.
Some state lawmakers, as I understand it, have been grousing about this last-minute rush, saying it wasn't necessary. So is there some finger-pointing going on up there on Beacon Hill?
There was earlier in the weekend. On Saturday, when it looked like no bills were going to emerge from any of the conference committees, a very frustrated Senate president laid the blame for the backlog on the House. He said they waited just too long to get the bills out of committees. Early this morning, after the session ended, he seemed a little less frustrated by the process.
I'm hoping we can talk about how to make things better and improve the process going forward in a collaborative way, not a hostile way. This isn't about pointing fingers and, you know, it's about how do we make things better.
How about Governor Baker, Steve? Was he around the State House building this weekend?
He wasn't around the building. His spokesman said that the governor and lieutenant governor, along with members of the administration, were actively engaged with legislators and had been monitoring the legislative priorities of the last 72 hours through meetings and phone calls. After the session ended, the governor did issue a written statement saying he's thankful the legislature took action on several important pieces of legislation, ranging from economic development to renewable energy. The governor will likely have more to say later today when he has his weekly meeting with legislative leaders.
WBUR's Steve Brown up all night following the action on Beacon Hill and with us this morning here on WBUR. Steve, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bob.
A Boston clinic for transgender youth has noticed something it can't explain. A high percentage of transgender children and teenagers are growing up in adoptive homes. The number of transgender youth it sees who are adopted is 3 to 4 times higher than the overall adoption rate statewide. WBUR's Martha Biebinger takes a look at what that might tell us about transgender young people and adults.
2 summers back, when Nathan Tasker was 13, his mom drove him from Melrose to Maine for a special transgender camp. Nathan said he was happy for the first time in years.
I finally was not alone.
But even here, Nathan expected to be different because he's transgender and adopted.
Well, I thought that, you know, I was just a package deal. Like, this only happens to one kid, like, in every place in the world. But I was like, you know what? There are a lot of adopted kids who are trans, and that's pretty amazing.
Doctors at Boston Children's Hospital Gender Management Service Clinic, where Nathan is a patient, started making the same connection last year.
We had been noticing that a seemingly high percentage of our patients were adopted or living with adoptive families.
Dr. Daniel Schumer treated transgender kids at Boston Children's Hospital for 3 years. He moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan to open a similar program last year, but pored through the files in Boston before he left. He found that 8.2% of the 184 young people who've come to the clinic since it opened in 2007 were raised in adopted families. The adoption rate overall in Massachusetts is 2.3%.
There may be a true link between being adopted and being transgender, but another possibility is that adoptive families may be more likely to present to clinics for help for their transgender child.
There are a few reasons why. Adoption experts say it's a fact. Adopted children seek and receive more counseling and care. When it comes to transgender care, Schumer says families of adopted children appear less likely to be ashamed of their child and more likely to seek help. That idea resonates with Dr. Johanna Olson Kennedy, who runs a clinic for transgender youth in Los Angeles.
When parents have biological children that are transgender, what happens is a big blame game. I have heard many families say, well, you know, my husband has 2 gay cousins or my wife has a trans aunt.
Olson Kennedy says that doesn't usually happen with the families of adopted kids. But could there be something about the experience of adoption that helps explain the link? Dr. Schumer says maybe.
As adoptive kids are becoming teenagers, they may more actively consider their gender identity in the context of their overall identity than kids that aren't adopted, that aren't going through as rigorous an identity thought process.
That's a new but reasonable thought, says Adam Pertman, president of the National Center on Adoption and Permanency.
Identity and adoption is a complex issue. I mean, it's complex for everybody, but there's a whole nother layer for adopted people that sort of triggers, in many of them, a deeper look within themselves about identity. And maybe this is part of what they find.
I think it's a stretch, frankly.
Jamison Green, the immediate past president of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, says all of these theories are interesting guesses, but just that.
People, in trying to understand what transness is and how it manifests and why some of us are this way, will elicit all kinds of conjectures.
Green has many of his own questions. He is, after all, adopted. Could there be something triggered by an early separation from the biological mother, or something neurological linked to reasons a mother gives her child up for adoption?
It speaks to how little we actually know. There's much more to be learned about transness, about gender identity development in all people.
There appears to be just one other study on transgender adoption rates. In 1998, a Toronto clinic found a similarly high percentage of adoption among transgender youth than among children as a whole. The Boston researchers are presenting their findings at conferences and have submitted a paper for publication. It leaves the question about why there's a higher rate of adoption among transgender youth seen at some clinics open for discussion. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.